It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the status of international efforts to contain the Ebola epidemic in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The World Health Organization gave its latest update on the outbreak last week, warning that the transmission of Ebola remains intense in the capitals of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. But for the first time in months, officials at WHO also indicate that new cases of Ebola are declining, potentially as a result of an increase in the number of safe burials, tracing of people who have had contact with Ebola patients, and an aggressive public awareness campaign. For its part, the U.S. government is focused on helping contain the disease at its source, with over 13,000 cases and some 5,000 deaths in West Africa so far. Through a program called Operation United Assistance, led by the Department of Defense, about 1,100 military personnel have already deployed to West Africa, and they're making a difference in Liberia with the construction of up to 17 Ebola treatment units, the first of which will be completed in early November. They are in the process of more than doubling their mobile laboratory capacity, going from the current 3 labs to a total of 7. They began training Liberian healthcare providers in Monrovia. The 25-bed hospital they have been building in Monrovia will be fully operational next week, and troops in Senegal are supporting all these efforts by coordinating the flow of supplies, equipment, and personnel. President Obama declared the Ebola epidemic in West Africa a top national security priority, and Operation United Assistance is a testament to U.S. commitment to stopping the outbreak.
When others are in trouble, when disease or disaster strikes, Americans help. And no other nation is doing as much to make sure that we contain and ultimately eliminate this outbreak than America.
President Obama reiterated in a White House briefing to honor U.S. health workers that the only way to defeat Ebola or prevent it from reaching other countries is to stop the epidemic at its source. He praised health workers who had recently returned from West Africa and those planning to go, saying they were heroes who serve with skill and courage. He does not want to discourage other healthcare workers from going to the front lines because of recent policies on quarantines in some U.S. states that are based more on fear than on science. Well, for more on the U.S. and international efforts to contain the Ebola epidemic, as well as the political, social, and economic ramifications of the virus, we turn to two distinguished analysts. J. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington-based think tank. And Christy Rogers. She's managing director and CEO of Aspen Healthcare Services. And in response to the Ebola crisis, Aspen Healthcare Services initiated a full-fledged medical clinic in Monrovia, Liberia. Both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Well, Christy Rogers, let me begin with you because I know you had staff in Monrovia recently. They just returned from the field. But actually, just before we get into their report, I want to talk briefly about what's been going on here in the United States. We had a case recently, a nurse returning from the field from Sierra Leone, and even though she showed no symptoms and tested negative twice for the Ebola virus, the state of Maine, where she lives, required her to be in quarantine. Of course, she's challenging that. The question is, how do you think here in the United States we need to balance public health, but also the public fear of the spread of the virus against, of course, the rights of healthcare workers? How do you see this dilemma?
Well, it is a dilemma, unfortunately, and it really shouldn't be. I think there has been a lack of a message and consistent message across the government. And what happens when there isn't a consistent message is fear takes over. It's very easy to go to fear when there's nothing else being explained out there. So I actually think a consistent message needs to be delivered at the federal government level and the state and local government level. They need to be in unison. And it should be fairly simple to do that because the health experts are pretty much in agreement on this. I would agree wholeheartedly that our efforts and our focus should really be on containment at the source.
And that means encouraging healthcare workers like this nurse to go forward and not to be stigmatized upon their return.
Absolutely.
Turning to you, J. Peter Pham, what's your take on what's going on here in the United States, the hysteria? To what extent are we looking at politics, and to what extent are there valid fears, and what should be done about it?
Well, I think there's a little of both, Carol. Certainly politics, we are in the electoral cycle just days before the midterm election, so there's going to be politics. But the politics, even without the electoral calendar, probably would have been there because, as Chrissy said, there's been a lack of clear message and consistent messaging from the government at all levels. And when there is that lack, fears are going to run amok. So I think there's a legitimate criticism to be made of the handling of the epidemic and the few cases we've had in the United States.
Let's go to Africa, and back to you, Chrissy Rogers. With respect to U.S. efforts, your particular clinic, how that's doing, and the report you got from your staff, and generally, how you think this U.S.-led effort in particular is going. Are we going fast enough to catch up to the disease and to the infection rate? Of course, the CDC predicted in a worst-case scenario that 1.4 million cases in Sierra Leone and Liberia may materialize by mid-January. Your assessment of efforts thus far?
Well, we've been sending staff, whether it's paramedics, nurses, doctors, admin staff, back and forth from Liberia since June. And we're currently serving roughly about 1,000 individuals. Now, we have not yet opened our doors to Ebola victims. We have recommended other clinics and other treatment facilities for them. Our focus for this particular clinic has been to provide the much-needed general public health care to the population. Essentially, with this crisis, the public health system has collapsed. So individuals don't have anywhere to go when they're coming down with malaria or when they have a broken arm. Women are having babies in the streets because essentially the largest hospital, JFK, has been completely shut down except for the treatment of Ebola patients. Now, that should be everyone's top concern. And governments, we believe, quite frankly, should be responsible for containing this virus. We are there to help them. We are currently working with the U.S. government and in conversations to staff and manage some of, if not all of those Ebola treatment units. Do I think we're going fast enough? Absolutely not. I don't. And I have been engaged in conversations with the U.S. government at all levels, probably since July, on how we can better position companies like myself to be able to help the government to respond to this.
First of all, I appreciate your feedback, and it's terrific what you're doing, because certainly one of the ramifications of this terrible disease is that the already weak health infrastructure is even weaker, and as you said, they cannot even address these other very important illnesses, diseases, whether malaria or just simply helping a woman give birth. So that's a terrific service that you're providing. But one more question to you. We know that UN Ambassador Samantha Power was recently in the area, and she's just pleading for more stepped up efforts by the international community. One can criticize the United States, but as President Obama said, we are probably, you know, giving the most of all, you know, in proportion to our abilities, which doesn't mean we can't always do more. Who, in your view, are some of the laggards, you know, countries or what other sources need to step up their efforts?
I'm an absolute firm believer and advocate, quite honestly, that health and health security is a global challenge. It's a global issue that should be addressed by all countries, their own health and then the health of their neighbors and across the board, because we live in a mobile society today. And it's the boundaries are not what they used to be, essentially. The United States has essentially taken responsibility for Liberia, the United Kingdom for Sierra Leone, and France for Guinea. Great efforts on their parts. We're actually working with the Germans as well, and I've been told that the Japanese are stepping up, as well as the Australians. Anything else I'm really not aware of, which is sad. There's a lot that can be done, but I also think that there's fear because the issue of quarantining, the issue of, you know, if we send our workers there, can we get them out? If we send our workers there, can they get their own aeromedical evacuation? What are their health services going to be? They haven't been addressed. I do also know that there are numerous companies that have been operating in Liberia for years who have shut their doors because of these concerns as well. In the early days, about July, August, there were a lot of companies that were coming to us, whether they were U.S. large companies or other international companies, mining, oil, construction, who were willing to step in and help. And they were saying, look, we've got these corporate social responsibility programs. We want to contribute some money. We want to help with the public campaign and awareness. What can we do? We're not getting any responses from the UN or the various governments on what role the private sector can play. So I think that needs to be considered as well. You know, what efforts, in addition to the governments, can the private sector do to help support and help really bolster the effort, because they employ thousands of people in these countries. And that's a really big network that I really don't think we've tapped.
A very good point. Turning to you, Peter Pham, to pick up on what Christy Rogers was saying, of course, you have your finger on the pulse of who's investing in Africa. So my question to you is, what about China? We have a headline from the Wall Street Journal, fearful Chinese firms rethink Africa. They have a lot to gain, the resources, bauxite in Guinea, and et cetera. I'd like to get your take on how successful the UN or the coordinating arm for all these Ebola efforts is doing, or how successful it is or is not with respect to fundraising from other countries, particularly China, which has a great vested interest in Africa, in these countries in particular. And what about those U.S. firms in Liberia that Christy says are interested in helping? Are we tapping into them? What is their role?
As far as the international response, one has to be frank and say it's been, with the exception of the countries that Christy just mentioned, the United States, which has taken a lead with more than $350 million in assistance, including over $100 million in humanitarian assistance, the Department of Defense response, the sending of the military personnel to build clinics, to build infrastructure, that's probably going to cost over $1 billion out of the Pentagon's budget.
Right.
And so the U.S. has been very generous, as the American people always are in these circumstances. And as Christy said, France has stepped up, Great Britain has stepped up, the European Union as a whole has stepped up. But the rest of the international community, to be quite frank, has left a bit to be desired. China has finally agreed to send several hundred medical personnel. They actually haven't arrived yet, but they've talked about it. The UN set up a trust fund for countries that weren't sending personnel or weren't sending aid directly to the affected countries. And at the 2-week point after the appeal was launched, there was a grand total of 100,000 in that trust fund, which was a one contribution from Colombia. What's been interesting has been the African response.
Yes. Go into that, please.
Certainly, some of the neighboring countries, Nigeria, for example, very early on, before actually the rest of the international community recognized the epidemic, made a very modest but still symbolic contribution of roughly $500,000 for each of the three most affected countries. African volunteers have been coming forward, trickling in, but they have been coming. Nigeria recently just announced a week ago that there would be approximately 500 medical personnel sent from Nigeria to the affected countries. Mm-hmm. What I would say, though, about the African countries has been that two of them in particular, Senegal and Nigeria, both of which had Ebola cases, have really set a certain standard by the fact that they both managed to become Ebola-free, which means they went through two 21-day cycles with no new infection. So they licked the spread of the virus within their borders. And so I think there are some lessons to be learned there as well from African countries.
And the AU, what role are they playing as a coordinator, perhaps, of assistance from all of Africa?
Well, they've made appeals and other statements, but really, to be quite frank, it's been on a bilateral basis primarily.
Notwithstanding its own internal problems, do you think Nigeria is doing enough that is commensurate with its capacity to contribute to containing Ebola in its neighbors?
I would argue that Nigeria actually has proven its effectiveness in preventing a global catastrophe. Ebola arrived in Nigeria because of a Liberian government consultant who arrived and literally collapsed with the fever in the arrivals hall at Lagos International Airport. That would have been a disaster. Lagos is one of the most densely populated, over 20 million people. It could have been a veritable disaster. But the Nigerians reacted very quickly and for once put their political differences aside between the federal and state government in Lagos, between the public sector and the private sector. They really pulled together and within a few days had a rapid reaction center up and running. They tracked down not only the man, but everyone he had been in contact with and people they had been in contact with, and identified roughly 900 at-risk individuals and subjected them to twice daily medical checkups and monitoring. They had individual contacts with people those individuals had been in contact with, to the extent where they knocked on some 26,000 doors and interviewed 18,500 people. And so at the end of the day, Nigeria managed to, by that direct contact, getting information. They used social media, developed an app so that medical information could be tracked almost in real time. Broad advertising campaign on radio, television, billboards, social media to get the right information out. It was really an integrated approach. It's really an example, really, that we could pick up a few points on ourselves.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, from whom you just heard, and Christy Rogers. She's a managing director and CEO of Aspen Healthcare Services, which recently set up a clinic in Monrovia, Liberia. We're talking about progress toward containing the Ebola epidemic in West Africa and the social, economic, and political political implications of the virus. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter Online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Nigeria, Femi Bami Doro. He's from Ibadan. And thanks for your feedback, Femi. Well, back to you, Christy Rogers. And I'd like to pick up briefly on what Peter Pham was saying about Nigeria as a potential model in the way it actually thwarted the epidemic. How would you assess these efforts in the hotspots, whether in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea? Are the authorities and local healthcare workers, are they doing enough to isolate people, make sure that these burials, which have been a sore point and which have played a role in spreading the virus, are the education campaigns sufficient? Because we know that as much as curing patients and treating patients is important, we need to prevent the transmission and cut the chain of transmission.
Absolutely. I commend Nigeria all across the board for their response. It really was what it needed to be, and that was rapid across all spectrums. The social media was critical in what they did, and the tracking was exceptionally important to contain this. What we're seeing, and I'll speak specifically to Liberia, it is spreading so fast and has decimated communities and families. We, the international collective response, has not really looked at community-level communication. In Liberia, you already had an extraordinarily weak public health infrastructure system with only 2,000 medical professionals across the country. So they were already stretched very thin before this Ebola ever came in to hit their communities, and they were not equipped whatsoever to handle this. And I think the international response didn't really understand how much they would be expected to do. And I think this is another place, and I'll say it again, where companies who are already operating on the ground and employ thousands of Liberians really could have engaged their employees, could have gotten into the communities. Firestone did an exceptional job and continues to do an exceptional job in Liberia, where they actually set up a community engagement for all of their employees, working with the families, setting up their own health clinic, and they've actually contained it. So all of their workers and their families are free from Ebola. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned across this, and the use of technology and social media and community organization are three very important points that I don't think we've really maximized yet.
Turning to you, Peter Pham, this gets to some reports we're reading where there are discrepancies. For example, we hear that there is a decline in new cases as measured by empty beds in some Ebola clinics. At the same time, skeptics are saying, well, not so fast. Possibly what is happening is we are not counting properly, that this may be true in some parts of the country, in Liberia and Sierra Leone, but in the remote areas, some people don't even know or haven't heard of Ebola. How do you account for this discrepancy? And would you agree that that's a problem?
If the rate of the spread is declining, even temporarily, that's a good thing. But I would caution, I realize in a crisis, people are grasping for any silver lining, any good news. And I think that might be the case here with the decline, because there's a lot that we do not know. Because of the poor infrastructure in terms of roads, in terms of communication, in terms of really social infrastructure for the spread of correct information, the gathering of information, because of all these things, we really don't really have a complete picture yet. That's one of the reasons it's important for the U.S. military personnel to be concentrated not in treating patients, but rather in building infrastructure, because that's the only way private groups, clinics, humanitarian workers, all the rest can come in and do their job.
And presumably they are building infrastructure in these remote areas, that is, where people are very far away from the Ebola centers in the capitals. Is that right?
Well, I think they will get to that. But the problem is Liberia and Sierra Leone in particular, because of their history, are just recovering from two very long civil wars. The infrastructure, even to receive the aid coming in and the aid workers, is non-existent. Monrovia has one working traffic light. We're really starting from zero, if not below zero, in terms of infrastructure. So it's going to take a while before all of this reaches out to the hinterlands or even to provincial towns.
Back to you, Christy Rogers. Again, with respect to the remote areas and reaching people through education campaigns, what efforts are you seeing being made in this regard, whether it's the international community, local workers? You know, to what extent are they getting orders, whether from their leaders in Liberia, Sierra Leone, to make headway into these remote areas and to help educate people who are not only ignorant, perhaps, of the virus, but, you know, are illiterate. So this makes the challenge all the more difficult.
Absolutely, it does. And you're right. In a lot of these areas, it needs to be a face-to-face verbal communication, because of the lack of technology, because of the lack of literacy. You know, they are improving and they are increasing. We're seeing more international organizations and some NGOs that are helping with that. But I can't overemphasize what Peter said, in that the roads are so poor. It is sometimes near impossible to get out to some of these areas unless you actually have helicopters. You know, some of the roads are impassable. So that has presented a challenge. We are seeing that it is improving.
And before we close, I wanted to get your sense of to what extent are we, that is, you know, the international community and those local countries, making some headway in containing this epidemic?
I think we will contain it. You know, it will be contained. When? Don't know. Will we see more cases pop up in other countries? Yes. You know, and we can't be afraid of that. We have to have a rapid response, as Nigeria exemplified. They will pop up, but I think we will contain this. My real concern is the public health infrastructure after. And Aspen is there now, and we will be there, you know, after this virus is contained, really trying to work with not just the Liberians, but with the region, and trying to improve their public health infrastructure with training of various medical and health professionals so we can actually provide jobs and reopen some of these hospitals and clinics that have shut their doors. I think that's something that's going to be a long-lasting negative impact of this Ebola crisis.
Before I turn back to Peter Fahn for the last word, talking about longer-term impacts, I'd like to get your assessment on what those might be. We already know that there are so many orphans because parents have died of the disease. What are the implications of so many orphans? We read about food crisis as a result of Ebola. So many people who normally are in the fields producing food maybe have succumbed to the disease. How do you see these longer-term impacts?
Well, from what we're seeing, the Liberians want to get back to work. They want the schools to reopen. They want to get back to work on the economy. They were really sort of on the upswing. Now, granted, as Peter was saying, it was coming from a pretty low, you know, low level. But we're seeing real spirit amongst the Liberians and within the private sector as well, the oil, the gas, the mining companies, construction companies from all across the world wanting to help them do that and sort of pick themselves up by the bootstraps. But I think, you know, it's going to take a long time because across the board, it's been decimated. The economic devastation is something we all really have to pay attention to, because if the economy is not stable, or if it's a very poor economic condition combined and exacerbated by the fact that the healthcare is really bad, you're really going to lead to a destabilized situation. And that's not good for the region. It's clearly not good for the citizens of those countries. So the global effort needs to remain long after Ebola is contained.
Well, Peter Fahn, the last word to you regarding the current impediments to really getting ahead of this terrible epidemic, as well as the long-term impacts, whether it has to do with all the orphans that will be roaming the streets unless their needs are being addressed, whether it's the food crisis, whether it's economic devastation.
Our first and primary objective at the moment has to be to contain the spread of the Ebola virus, to treat those infected, and to deal with those immediate issues. We can't lose sight of the short, medium, and long-term impacts that we also need to have a certain responsibility to helping cope with. Christy's mentioned, very importantly, the rest of the public health sector for people who don't have Ebola but have other ailments or simply require routine care now and in the weeks and months to come. There's the financial impact that you've alluded to. These were three countries starting with a very low base, but were growing. Now, all three of them, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, are probably going to see anywhere between a third to half of the growth they would experience this year cut. That's already in the estimates, and this will spill over into next year. That's leading, just this year alone, into a roughly a quarter of $1 billion shortfall in government revenues. So the government's just to stay where they are and not regress are in need of at least $250 million. And then the impacts on years to come. Projects have been halted, not necessarily because the companies want to halt them, but because subcontractors or sub-subcontractors have refused to service them or have left the country. So major projects, which would lead to employment and economic growth down the line. And then ultimately, we have the social impact. The fact that people are fearful, distrustful of government, of each other, because of the spread of this disease. And this is coming in societies that have just come out of conflict. It's going to take a lot of time to heal, to reconcile, and to, if you will, reweave that social fabric. The disease, God willing, is going to be licked in a matter of weeks or months. But the impact of the disease and its spillover into other sectors, it's really going to be a matter of years to fully recover.
Just one very quick follow-up. It goes without saying that the World Bank, IMF, other institutions are going to have to help with these longer-term issues. But what about, as Christy mentioned, the role of private companies, particularly U.S. companies, but not just? I think she hit on a very important point. Just as the United States is trying to promote greater U.S. investment in the continent, and of course now the Ebola epidemic more or less overshadowing this important matter. Peter Pham, to what extent does this outbreak, unless it is contained, tarnish sort of the image of the entire continent, even though it's affecting primarily these three countries, and inhibit people and companies from investing, which is going to be critical for the economic welfare of not just those three countries, but the entire continent?
As Christy mentioned earlier, the companies already there have largely stepped up to the plate. But unfortunately, Ebola will have a negative impact because the narrative of the Africa rising, Africa emerging, which remains true, these three countries together, the high impact countries, have a total population of maybe 21 million in a continent of a billion. So not to minimize the human tragedy, but it's certainly the larger picture of Africa youthful, Africa dynamic, Africa growing is being lost because it's Ebola all the time. Even during the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, disappointingly, the full coverage right before the summit was on the two American victims who were brought home. They certainly deserve our compassion and interest, but that crowded out summit coverage. And the day after the summit ended, hearings were held on the Ebola crisis. So that bookended the summit and its message, unfortunately.
Exactly. Well, hopefully the good news will still supersede the bad, but we need to be concentrating on eradicating the epidemic at its source. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Christy Rogers, Managing Director and CEO of Aspen Healthcare Services. Thanks so much to both of you for your tremendous insights.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Brian Marcoulier. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.